University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Charles Milligan, professor of philosophy of religion at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, speaking on the beautiful and the holy, ambiguity and necessity. Milligan is a graduate of the University of Denver and Iliff School of Theology. He is an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ and has been a member of the Iliff faculty since 1957. He has written a guide to contemporary philosophy of religion and is currently editor of the Iliff Review.
Today, Nebraska Wesleyan University is very fortunate to have upon its campus a person that embodies the goals that we at times discuss, espouse, and aspire to. Today we are fortunate to have here as our speaker for this religious emphasis lecture Dr. Charles Milligan, who is professor of religion at the, or professor of philosophy of religion at the Iliff School of Theology, but a man whose life has been dedicated to the pursuit of what we call the liberal arts, a man who has attempted not only to deal in the realm of philosophy and theology, but is an accomplished musician and had and has a strong interest in the arts, is the holder of two doctorates, one from the Iliff School of Theology and the other from Harvard University. So a diverse man who has several connections to Nebraska Wesleyan that I would like to point out before we hear Dr. Milligan's address. An alum of this institution is a man by the name of William Bernhardt, who went from Nebraska Wesleyan to the University of Chicago and then became a professor at the Iliff School of Theology and a seminal thinker and leader at that institution. The major interpreter of the work of William Bernhardt, the Nebraska Wesleyan alum, is none other than Dr. Charles Milligan. So on that point alone, we are in a great position to have him here today. But there's a specialness that brings Dr. Milligan back to our campus that many of our guests do not have, a special relatedness and a special connectedness, because Charles's son, Stuart, is a 1975 graduate of this institution, majored in theater arts, and continues to pursue a career in the arts in London, acting, and still speaks fondly of this institution and did not discourage his father from coming. With that background, we would like to welcome the religious emphasis speaker for the spring 1987 to speak on the topic of the beautiful and the holy, ambiguity and necessity, Dr. Charles Milligan.
Thank you very much, Bill, for that gracious introduction. It's a temptation to respond to some of the things that he said, to respond in some detail, and I'm not going to do that. But I want you to know I appreciate it very much, and certainly you are correct about there being some fond associations in my mind with this place. In thinking about the relationship between the sense of the holy and the sense of the beautiful, there is a line from Robert Frost which encapsulates the focus. This quatrain comes at the end of one of Frost's later poems. And were an epitaph to be my story, I'd have a short one for my own. I would have written of me on my stone, I had a lover's quarrel with the world. That sets the frame, I think, for what I want to say about the relationship between the holy and the beautiful. Basically, an alliance here, a lover's quarrel, loyalty, an affirmation, a positive identity, but within that, a few and perhaps even more than a few quarrels, a few things that are by way of objection, and things that are not liked, and sometimes those can be quite intense. And there is also in Prost, as well as in the relationship that I have in mind to explicate this morning, a cantankerous streak, a kind of New England Yankee contrary streak, such as that that Frost celebrates in West Running Brook, this brook that instead of running east to the ocean goes west, but eventually winds up in the ocean anyway, a contrary tendency. I lived for 3 years just east of West Running Brook, and so it has special meaning for me too. Well, that's similar to the way that I see this relationship between the beautiful and the holy. On the one hand, there's a certain inescapable necessity about their relationship. It seems to me, I'll try to justify this claim, that they are bound together in a certain sense. But certainly, there are tensions between them, and I will allude to the way a number of those things have come about in history and it seems to me in contemporary thought and life as well. Now, a lot of things enter into this rivalry, if we call it that, and one of these can be a kind of professional rivalry, a professional competition, if you will. For example, who can remember the name of the Pope that hired Michelangelo to do the paintings in the Sistine Chapel? Possibly somebody here can remember that. But imagine if you were a pope and held what is a relatively important office in the world of religion, to be relegated to a footnote in reference to that because of Michelangelo. There would be an understandable degree of rivalry there. And who commissioned the sacred music of Mozart? And as for that, who cares? there must have been several people who did that, but they would be lucky to be much more than a footnote in a history that is mainly about Mozart. What is the name of the woman for whom the Taj Mahal was erected as memorial and tomb? The building lives. And in all these places, people go and are caught up and inspired in something that is an unforgettable event in their lives by the thousands upon thousands. And the shutters of the cameras click, and then the photographs are shared and used to bore their friends and so on. I remember when the New York Philharmonic had an afternoon program. And the announcer would say something like this: today's concert is brought to you by courtesy of, and then name some corporation that hardly anyone could remember. It would be a good trivia question for older people. I could not remember, and I looked it up, and I was actually able to find it. And the Philharmonic program was brought to you by courtesy of Willis Overland. And many of you would not even know that that referred to an automobile manufacturer. That has passed out of the picture. And even at that time, when I was very young, it occurred to me that they had it backwards and that we were tolerating a commercial from Willis Overland, thanks to Beethoven and Toscanini, if you want to get it straight. So Theophile Gautier has celebrated this aspect of the picture, the immortality, the love that people pour out, the way in which they're fascinated by and held by things of beauty. So this is in Santayana's translation. All things are doubly fair if patience fashion them and care. Verse, enamel, marble, gem. All things return to dust, save beauties fashioned well. The bust outlasts the citadel. Oft doth the plowman's heel, breaking an ancient clod, reveal a Caesar or a god. The gods too die, alas. But deathless and more strong than brass remains the sovereign song. Chisel and carve and file, till thy vague dream imprint its smile on the unyielding flint. The gods perish, but their temples, even in ruins, draw throngs of open-mouthed visitors. Two or three weeks ago, I was in Oaxaca, Mexico, and spent time there visiting the pyramids of the pre-Columbian Indians and the museum where the artifacts are gathered there. And it was simply astonishing how expert and with what care and fine skill some of these artworks were wrought by those ancient peoples. Now, some gurus and religious authorities have justified the arts because they provide a channel for their business, for expressing worship and for expressing praise and so forth, and that is true. But it is much more than that. It is equally, at least with some people, the case that religious concepts are justified because they provide themes for poets and painters, sculptors and storytellers. And I suspect that many a church musician has endured things that did not thrill the church musician because religion provided the occasion and the means and the wherewithal and so on in order to express whatever it was in terms of the language of music. And so you find that there's an understandable tension here, and in part it's professional or it's an argument about turf or something like that. But either way, this strong tie between religion and beauty, the devotion of faith and the creativity of the arts, remains and has always remained. So that however far back you go in terms of archaeology and excavations and things like that, you find this connection between what is believed about ultimacy in the nature of things and in life and the human capacity for creative expression in some form of beauty. If certain arts are driven from the temple, then others sneak in the back door, as it were, and take over with intensified expressiveness. For example, in Islam, it is forbidden to have representational art. You may not have sculpture, you may not have paintings or anything that depicts that, and that comes out of the prohibition against not only making graven images and worshiping them, but making a likeness of anything that is on the earth or in the heavens or on the ocean or under the ocean and in the seas and so on, any kind of likeness. So what do you get? You get these breathtaking, exquisite forms of calligraphy and mosaics all through in the Hagia Sophia and the Blue Mosque and Umayyad Mosque in Jerusalem and Taj Mahal and in the manuscripts everywhere. It just floods throughout the Byzantine world and times. And in Eastern Orthodoxy, now, in terms of the controversy that took place, it was decided in Western Christendom that, because some people thought there ought not to be any art at all. I think the problem was simply this, that art so excited them, and they loved it so much they were frightened of it. Do you know that in Plato's Republic, he would have among the laws that he recommended that flute players be banished from the cities? The only place that the flute players could play their flute were if they were shepherds and out in the country where nobody could hear them. Not because, as with some flute players, you might want to do that. But when you think about Middle Eastern music, you know, Greek music, Arabic music, Turkish music, you start to think of belly dancers and things like that. And it's so exciting. That was why. And Aristotle went a step further than that. In his Politicus, he would ban flute players from the state altogether because it was so powerful. And in both of those cases, it had nothing whatever to do with religious concepts. It had to do with the safety of the state. Well, I was going to say that in Eastern Orthodoxy, it was decided that you could not have three-dimensional representational works of art. You couldn't have statues, but you could have two-dimensional. And so, for example, in the Greek Orthodox Church, icons are terribly important. And iconography, the magnificence of human creativity in icons is just extraordinary in the Greek Orthodox Church. And if you turn to the historic literature of the Orthodox Church as compared with the Western Roman Catholic Church and later Protestant Church, the writings of the theologians and the philosophers about the religious significance of the arts is 100 times richer in the Eastern Church than it is in the Western, where they permitted more art. You compress it here and it comes out there. It's irrepressible. I submit that there is this hunger, this appetite for beauty, for participation in processes of beauty or the creation of it or response to it. And so for this purpose, I will define the beautiful as that which nourishes the soul. That which nourishes the soul. So I'm talking about the event or the experience of the beautiful, and I have deliberately done this, or tried to, in such a way that it will take into account our extraordinary range of difference that people have among people in what they regard as beautiful. And you know how extraordinary that range of difference is. What is ugly to one person is beautiful to another. So there's a tremendous range of relativity there. As was mentioned in the introduction, music is a special love of mine. I say that because what I'm going to say now is not very complimentary to music and comes from people of a different attitude. There was a review or a report of a social event at which there had been a violin solo, and Bertie Wooster wrote this about it, the violin solo. It was loud in spots and less loud in other spots. And it had that quality which I have noticed in all violin solos of seeming to last much longer than it actually did. And it reminds one of what a music teacher said plaintively on one occasion, but you have to remember that Wagner's music is much better than it sounds. Back in frontier times, Eugene Field was a newspaper reporter in Denver. And it was a kind of wild scene, as you can imagine, and occasionally there would be a cultural event that would come from the East. And on one occasion, it was a performance of Shakespeare's King Lear, and Eugene Field had one of the briefest reviews of a Shakespearean performance, I suppose, ever done, which he had one sentence that Shakespeare's King Lear was performed last night. An actor who shall remain nameless played the king as if expecting someone else to play the ace. One wonders if it was really that bad or if Eugene Field had thought up this one-liner and wanted an excuse to get it off. But surely there are these remarkable differences. And there are those people, and I really want to bear down on this mistake, who think of the arts as being justified if they're a device for teaching something. Now, they do teach things, and sometimes teach them very powerfully. And some of the things that they teach are very wholesome and ennobling and inspiring and encouraging and all that sort of thing. That obviously is the case. But often the didactic, the moralizing, the moralistic, the teaching kind of thing can be very ineffective. That's the most discouraging thing about it. Occasionally I officiate at weddings, and I stopped giving advice to people who are going to get married for two reasons. One, most of them don't listen, and number two, if they do listen, it doesn't do any good or make any difference. And so you might just as well save your breath. One of my favorite examples of where it is that moralistic didactic teachings failed to be effective was something I heard from a school teacher who was teaching fourth or fifth grade, and they had been studying various literary forms. One of these was the fable. And so the class was assigned to make up a fable and then to add a moral to it. And she told, quoted this fable that one of her students had written. A boy said, "Once upon a time, a boy went into the woods. The boy met a tiger. The tiger ate the boy. Moral: if you go into the woods, do not meet a tiger." And I think a lot of our moralizing is about as helpful as that. Now, if you think of the beautiful as that which nourishes the soul, by soul I mean simply the self in its deepest and most personal sense, and I'm not trying to smuggle in any particular psychology or religious doctrine on that. But people do have these different ideas, and to one person the cornfield is beautiful, and to another it's ugly. To many people trees are beautiful, but Samuel Johnson said to Boswell one time when Boswell was going out in the country, "If you see a tree, kick it for me." Have these differences. But to be nourished is to be satisfied, gratified, filled and fulfilled, and ending with a sigh of contentment, something like that. Beauty is to the soul as food is to the body, I say. So we have to make this distinction immediately between nourishment and simply momentary pleasure or a tickling sensation or something like that. This is nothing against momentary pleasure, and often that which is nourishing is also pleasurable. Fortunately, almost all food, with a few exceptions, that is nourishing is also delicious, and we enjoy it. But the nourishment, the essence of the nourishment, is in the strength and health that it gives to the body. It is not in the pleasure that occurs from the eating of it. Nothing against either function. I'm simply saying that often they go together, but they ought not to be confused. So when I emphasize the distinction between beauty as that which nourishes the soul and then other things that momentarily titillate or excite or give tickling sensation, I think the distinction is important. And beauty is somewhat different in its deeper and enduring meaning, I believe, because generally it includes within it tension, conflict, stress, dissonance, that quality. Or you take in music, this almost always, there are some exceptions, but music which is genuinely beautiful, if it's merely tuneful, it's insipid. But if it's really beautiful and grasps us in this sense, nourishes our soul in this sense, then it involves dissonance and modulation and contrast and this stress and sometimes strident discords. And then to the extent that there is resolution and harmony, not in the sense of concord, but harmony in the sense of the whole being gathered together, that realization, that achievement, occurs out of the very materials of the dissonance and the stress that is within it. Or you take drama. Imagine, if you will, a drama in which all of the characters were pleasant and sweet and all lovely and all of that. Let's imagine that someone might say, "I don't like Macbeth because it has these obnoxious people in it, and so I'm going to change the characters and I'm going to turn Macbeth into the gracious, caring host and Lady Macbeth into the sweet, subservient lady who takes orders from Macbeth and who waits on the people there." And so they have these house guests who come and they have a lovely time, and then they have more house guests that come and they have a lovely time and they have more house guests that come. Who would want to see it? Always in significant drama or novels or any sort of narrative literature, there is this element of tension. And then you may not just have a last chapter in which you replace the tension with the conclusion that is sweetness and light, But whatever conclusion it comes to has to grow out of that, so that the classic statement of what I'm talking about comes from John Dewey. That which distinguishes an experience as aesthetic is the conversion of resistance and tensions, of excitations that in themselves are temptations to diversion, into a movement toward an inclusive and fulfilling close. And so when it is over, even though you have wept with Desdemona or Othello, or you have been enraged at Macbeth, or you have sympathized deeply and sorrowfully with Hamlet or whatever, when it's over, is the thing to be said. And that's very, I submit that that's very like, the thing it is most like is enjoying a good meal. It was Epicurus who said that it was impossible for him to think meaningfully about the subject of values if he did not include in the discussion the pleasures of the stomach. And I submit to you that if somehow or other all of the value writings about value of philosophers were thrown out that forget the connection between food and the stomach, which after all is an elemental value for the sustenance and enhancement of life, which is what I mean by value, that most of the writing about values would be thrown out. And you'd get back to talking some real sense, if you keep in mind the value of food, which at this very moment, after all, is one of the crucial, obvious areas where civilizations have not advanced to the point that they can deal with this, either in the production or distribution or consumption of adequate food for people who grow it and people who consume it. This, incidentally, this quality of tension is very helpful, it seems to me, in understanding the dissatisfactions and puzzlement that many people have with modern art and art forms. After all, if art depicts life or in some way mirrors life, holds a mirror as it were up to nature, or if art in some way distills some bit of life or experience or meaning in some way, and then if life is going through a period of rapid change and fragmentation, and there are many chaotic things stirring in life, then art that relates to that aspect of our times is going to be chaotic and fragmented and not resolved into wholeness of some kind. So Dewey's idea of a fulfilling close is not going to be present in the artwork, and if that is found, it's going to be found by the observer or the spectator. I submit to you that a great deal of contemporary music, drama, novels, that sort of thing, a great deal of it is really borders on the absurd and the chaotic, and if any fulfilling closure is to be found, the reader has to provide that. The observer of the painting has to bring that to it or draw it out of it or impose it upon it, if it is to be found at all. That one problem with modern art is that it is participatory creation of beauty, and it makes demands upon you as an observer or a witness or a spectator or a reader that a lot of art did not make in times past, in which the aspects of life it was distilling might have been painful, but they were not chaotic. They were not suffused with the absurd or the meaningless or something of that quality. I am not implying, by the way, that all art that is alleged to do this is necessarily good art. I think a lot of it is terrible. And a lot of it I don't like. And it places demands on me that I'm not able to meet and carry out. But I have to be very cautious, because some things I have reacted to very negatively and badly upon greater acquaintance I have found to be extraordinarily meaningful and beautiful. A lot of other things I still think are trash or garbage. But I have recognized that my judgment is not nearly, particularly my first judgment, not nearly as infallible as once I had believed them to be. Now, will people stand for that? You know, just offhand, one's answer might be no. And then I think of this. But before I tell you what I'm thinking of, I want to say something so that you understand me in connection with experiences of the beautiful. I'm not thinking merely of great paintings and of Shakespeare and the celebrated in that sense. I'm also thinking of the homespun. I'm thinking of crafts. I'm thinking of those religious denominations that are skittish about the arts and try to move them out of their religious scene altogether. So what do those people do, the Shakers and early Quakers and Puritans and so on? You go to the museum to see the furniture they carved and the clothing and the linens and the lace and other things that they made. And you find beauty in their everyday lives that probably outstrips some of the things in our lives, unless we're very sensitive to the beauty that can be present in the homespun crafts, you know. So I'm thinking of the possibility of beauty and just all, it's where it's found. And that it's there if we can but see it, and we have different capacities. That's a little different from saying it's only in the eye of the beholder. Now, the thing that I think of that many people find meaningful and beautiful, that is very much like a lot of puzzling, dissonant modern art, is something that you have had some experience with or have heard about, namely an important football game. People will go to some trouble to attend it. They will endure some discomfort. But then think of the drama that is being enacted out there on the holy scene, the playing field, where the priests are there on the sidelines, the high priests. And then there are the novitiates and so on. And then there are the Vestal Virgins that come out and do their sacred dance and implore powers from the heavens to defeat the forces of evil and so on. They've got that scene going on, right? And is a football game altogether pleasant? No, you will see people holding their heads, screaming, oh no, saying uncomplimentary things about the officials. And then at the end of the game, you will see people with tears streaming down their cheeks. When there is another outdoor temple like the one I've just described in this city, I understand, where it relates to the religion of Big Red. And there are some people in Nebraska who take that enactment fairly seriously. And they go to some trouble about it. Now, do they come away when the team loses saying, oh, well, it's just a game. And do they then say, or it can be just a boring game. It's really boring when Nebraska plays Colorado. Do they say, well, I'm not going to any more football games. That was a lousy game. No, they say, I hope next week will be better. And they're there. The devotion, the sacrifice, all of that is involved. And if someone else said to them, I don't see why they can't decide what the game is going to be and remove this uncertainty element about it. And we'll have three or four basic plots. And these will be replayed ritualistically every week. You know, the very things that people complain about in modern art, in modern cinema, in the theater of the absurd, which after all, well, that would be blasphemous here to say that. Strike that. The very thing that people complain about in modern music, theater of the absurd, and so on, and chaotic paintings, that sort of thing, are the very things that they are devoted to in connection with sports. And you could find other examples where the same sort of thing would obtain. The experience of beauty may give pleasure, deep pleasure, but the essence of beauty is not in that. The essence of it is in this resolution of dissonance, and the resolution sometimes has to be supplied by you. Now, that's not entirely new. Socrates speaks of what we would call abstract art in Plato's Philebus. I will try to speak of the beauty of shapes, and I do not mean, as most people would suppose, the shapes of living figures or their imitations in painting, but I mean straight lines and curves and the shapes made from them by the lathe, ruler, or square. They are not beautiful for any particular reason or purpose, as other things are, but are eternally and by their very nature beautiful, and give a pleasure of their own quite free from the itch of desire. Now, I'll come back to this idea in a moment that whatever is beautiful is itself an instance of the holy, or as Plato puts it, which are by their very nature beautiful. But first, I must say a bit about the holy, and again, I don't want to use a formal definition, but a cryptic definition that takes account of the tremendous range of variety of events or things that people find in their experience to be holy for them, if you define it the way that I do. The holy, I submit, is that to which the soul resonates. The holy is that to which the soul resonates. And different people's souls resonate to different kinds of things. By resonate, I mean it responds. It's set in motion. In a way that reflects and blends into, and the cultural varieties, whatever, where people are awakened, and as if some inner music, silent music, something like that, were taking place within them, and life, and their self, their soul, as they respond life and find themselves in it. Sometimes this is in nature, as in the 42nd Psalm, when the refugee says, "Deep calleth unto deep at the noise of thy water spouts," something about the river and the cascading stream causes this reverberation within the soul, deep calling unto deep. Or it may be an understanding, something that dawns on us with a clarity and a penetrating insight that ties things together in a new way of depth, similar to St. Paul's words when he said, "The Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirits that we are the children of God." The Spirit itself, the Holy Spirit, that which is embedded deep in the heart of reality itself. Before I was born and after I shall no longer be. Something about that resonates with, bears witness with that which is deepest within the center of my being. Something very central, then resonating with something that is very real. That resonating effect is what I mean by the holy, and it occurs in different places. And these are then disclosure events, some of them personal and individual, and some of them events that take place with others, and many of them are not our own experiences at all, but they come to us from tradition and history, and which we then appropriate as if they were our experiences and reinterpreted by us, but meaningful to us because of the way that they galvanize our identity with those things in our tradition which we can affirm and clarify the sense of who we are. There are things which sanctify existence itself, and that's my justification for calling them holy. Now, there's nothing meant here that is spooky or strange or occult or anything like that. At least for me, that is the case. And so that I not be misunderstood, I'm going to run down a short list out of what could be a very long list of some events that have this kind of disclosure power for me. Gandhi fasting as a protest to stop the bloodshed when India was divided to create Pakistan. Marian Anderson singing in Constitution Hall at last. Albert Einstein's Christmas letter to the New York Times, paying tribute to the Christian churches, speaking as a Jew. Anwar Sadat going to Jerusalem. I just speak of that, and the world lights up for me. In a world that can be so dumb, there's a symbol that tends to redeem the meaning of life and have new heart about it. Bishop Tutu, a week ago, defying the latest restrictions by the South African regime. The Salk vaccine. Lou Gehrig's final public appearance on the baseball diamond. These are large, famous public events. There would be a lot of others that are not so well known or famous, perhaps, and then others that are personal or private or individual. You might think from this that I do not believe that religion creates the holy. And you would be right. I do not think that. I do not think that is the function of religion. One of the things that's wrong with a lot of people, and I think wrong with a lot of religion, is that people worship their religion. And the more you think about that, the sillier it is. I love my religion. I hope it is valid and that it grows. I'm sure it has some ideas in it that are not well founded and some things that are out of proportion, but it's mine and I love it. All of that. But what is it? It is a means by which I gather together this confusing, entangled, often frustrating life. And then this life that is so beautiful in some ways that it seems to me outrageous that there'll be a time when I don't exist. And how can the universe stand that? And I don't stand it very well. So I have to come to terms with that. And I do so by means of this framework of interpretation and meaning, which is my religion. Now, in connection with that, I'm sure there are many exceptions to what I'm going to say now, and I'm entering ground that I perhaps ought not to, but I'm telling you what I think. You're under no obligation to believe any of this, but I hope you're curious about it. But I think of the poet as a person who articulates the significance of life in some particularity, takes a bit of life and makes all life become vivid and illumined because of that one thing that is articulated or is preciously vivified and polished there. Whereas the theologian is someone who has the same task, articulating the significance of life, but in a systematic, prosaic fashion, and so that it attempts to apply to all life in its fullest range and provides a framework or a scheme of interpretation and symbols out of some tradition or language or other and to make it all hang together and be intelligible. So naturally, there is possible, there is a certain tension between the poet's articulation on the one hand and the theologian or the philosopher of life on the other hand. But theologian does this within a particular definite stream of tradition and reinterprets it. I haven't mentioned the philosopher because when I speak about philosophers, there's always this definition of the philosopher, and it gives me a bit of humility and caution. A philosopher is someone who writes about something that he or she does not understand in such a way as to make you think it's your fault. And there is something to that. We all have our pet jargon and so on. Within religion, then, Incidentally, I've been trying to avoid the word ambiguity, because I understand that some of you are taking a course in that, and you break into applause and shouts of joy every time you hear the word. But this illustrates that a bit. There have been different responses to this, and at about the beginning of the 7th century, there was the iconoclast controversy within the Western Christian Church, well, the Eastern Church too, as far as that goes, and whether art should be permitted or representative art should be permitted. The Pope at 600 AD was Gregory the Great, and he wrote a letter to the Bishop of Marseille, because there were some Christians at that time who said, art is so dangerous, so exciting, so erotic, so threatening, that Christians ought to try to remove it entirely out of sanctuaries and indeed, if possible, out of their lives. And then there were others who loved art and tolerated religion. And then in between, you had the church bureaucrats like popes and bishops and clergy and so on. And this is what Pope Gregory wrote. It has been brought to our attention that, inflamed by thoughtless zeal, you are destroying the images of saints under the pretext that they ought not to be worshipped. That you have prevented their being worshipped, we sincerely applaud, but that you have destroyed them, we censure. It is one thing to worship a picture. It is another to learn through a picture story what is to be worshipped. For what writing supplies to readers, painting offers to uneducated viewers, for in painting even the ignorant can see what course they should follow, and in painting the illiterate can read. So art is justified to the extent that it serves as a channel for the didactic purposes of the church, and indeed the empowerment of the devotion that the church tries to awaken. Now that, of course, that happens. There's nothing against that. But I do not think it's limited to that. We find a similar thing happening again more than 900 years later. Just after Luther had started the Protestant Reformation, in 1521, in his hometown of Wittenberg, two theologians had understood that in terms of Luther's teaching, all of the works of art, statues, beautiful things, should be destroyed. And so this is what Luther said. Dr. Karlstadt has deserted us, and on top of that has become our worst enemy. These honor-seeking prophets do nothing but break images, destroy churches, manhandle the sacraments, and seek a new kind of mortification. So he made the same distinction that Gregory had made, namely that images were permissible as long as they were not worshipped, as long as I use them as memorials, so he said. One historian writing about this recently praised religious art as painted sermons. Well, some of them are that, but I think that does not do justice to the holiness of that function. And religionists easily make the mistake of downgrading the secular arts and the practical, useful crafts, even when done in a way that can only be called beautiful. Well, my concluding comment here, I want to allude to an event that I heard reported on National Public Radio a year and a half ago, I think it was. The famous portrait photographer Karsh was having his 75th birthday. If you can recall the photograph of Winston Churchill where he sort of bent over. It's the most famous photograph of all the many of Churchill. Karsh was the photographer that took that picture. Karsh told this story himself. The interviewer, Bob Edwards or someone, said, "Of all of the honors that you have received, what is the greatest one that you have received?" And Karsh laughed and said, "It happened last week." In honor of his birthday, there was an exhibit of his famous portraits, photographs in New York. Karsh went there to see how they were displayed and so on. And there's one that he is particularly proud of. It was of Pablo Casals. And he had spent several days trying to capture in a photograph the essence of this man, surely one of the greatest musicians ever, and certainly of our time. And he just couldn't get it right. And so he gave up, and Casals said, well, let's wait for a while. And Casals started to play Bach unaccompanied sonata for cello. And somehow in the middle of that, when Casals was totally enraptured with Bach and had forgotten about Karsh, Karsh sneaked up on him and took the picture. It was in front of that picture that there was an old man, even older than Karsh, standing there leaning on his cane and not moving. And that pleased Karsh. 3 days later, Karsh came back to see how it was going, and there was that same man standing before the Casals photograph. And so he went up to him and he said to him, excuse me, sir, but what is it that you find so absorbing in this photograph? And the man turned and said with a bit of anger, hush, son, can't you see I'm listening to the music?
Today, University Forum has presented Charles Milligan, Professor of Philosophy of Religion at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, speaking on the beautiful and the holy, ambiguity and necessity. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.